Welcome to Healthcare is Hard, a podcast for insiders. Each episode, LRV Health's Keith Figlioli will talk to the healthcare insiders who are helping to fundamentally transform our healthcare industry.
Hey everyone, this is Tom Salemi. Welcome back to Healthcare is Hard, a podcast for insiders. Joined by our great host, Keith Figlioli of LRV Health. Keith, how are you doing today?
Doing terrific. It's a great, glorious day here in Boston today.
It is. It is. We really do appreciate this great weather. And you made a visit to Southern California, which ironically on the day they did not have great weather, but you did have a great conversation with Joe Randolph of the Innovation Institute. What's going on at the Innovation Institute?
Yeah, there's not many times you fly into Southern California and it's not sunny and beautiful, but this particular day, it wasn't. But so Joe Randolph is a really interesting person in that, you know, he comes and is a true insider from sort of healthcare administration and was the CFO for a long period of time at St. Joe's in Orange County, a health system that is now part of Providence, and then also became the COO there. And so sort of has multiple views on the ground from a financial lens and an operational lens at a pretty large, prominent healthcare system. And through that incubated the thing that he now runs, which is called the Innovation Institute, which is made up of a number of healthcare systems as owners. And, you know, has a really interesting story to tell in terms of how they've put this together. And more importantly, how it's really benefiting health systems. They think about disruption trends and innovation trends and technology transfers and alternative revenue streams, all the things that's very sort of top of mind today for your average healthcare system set of leaders. And he's put this organization together in a way that becomes really an extension of these organizations and very helpful to sort of dealing with those types of topics on a day-to-day basis.
And it's been around for a few years. So these healthcare systems have been looking at innovation or a way of developing innovative ideas for 4 or 5 years?
Yeah, they've been around for a number of years. They've put the organization together in a very similar, very interesting way, I should say, not simple way, in that it's not really just an accelerator or a tech transfer organization. At the core is a lab structure. And so they physically put people into health systems to sort of run overall technology transfer ideation processes through the various clinicians and other people within an organization. And then they have people in the back room where IP lawyers, prototyping people, commercialization type people that help the average health system think about how do they generate revenue from some of the ideas that come out. So they've put, I think, 10 different ideas into the commercial phase and starting to generate revenue on that standpoint on behalf of the health systems. The other interesting thing that they do is they also have a number of larger companies that look like outsourced services that help drive the overall financials as well as set of services to the health systems. And, you know, these are a large collection of companies that make up, I think, almost about $250 to $300 million in revenue a year. And these are things are like laundry services, construction services, clinical engineering, things to that degree that every health system uses. But if they aggregate them together almost in a group purchasing like way, they can get more benefit out of that. And they also have financial impact back to the Innovation Institute and the members. And then they also have a fund, venture capital fund relationship. And that's actually with us. And that's how we got to know Joe very well. And so it's been a really great relationship for us. I think it's been a great relationship for them. And it's been a great relationship for some of the health systems that are associated with it as well.
Fantastic. Sounds like a great conversation. Let's hear more from Joe Randolph, the CEO of the Innovation Institute.
So we're on to our next podcast. I'm here with Joe Randolph, the president and CEO of the Innovation Institute. We're in glorious, sunny Southern California, but it's a little overcast today. Hopefully it'll break out by the time we get out this afternoon.
Yeah, it should break off around then.
Good. Well, Joe, it's great to have you on this.
Well, thank you for having me. Yeah. I'm looking forward to the conversation.
So if you've heard a little bit of our podcast, we always start out with a little bit of background on yourself and would love to learn a little bit more about yourself. You've been a fixture down here in Southern California for a long period of time in the healthcare ecosystem. But love to hear a little bit about your background and talk a little bit sort of how you got into healthcare to start out.
Well, right out of college, I started in healthcare and started with a company called Pacific Health Resources. And it was I was in the internal audit area and finance. And so I kind of grew up in the finance sector, CFO of hospitals, CFO at the St. Joseph Health System, where I spent most of my career, 25 years, CFO at the system for 10 years, and then COO for 5 years, just preceding coming to the Innovation Institute.
Wow. And so what was, so when you first got into this, and was it just sort of the path that took you, sort of finance, and then you said, oh, healthcare is an interesting place to be, or?
I was always fascinated by healthcare. I thought, you know, there's an industry that's going to be around. When I started out, I thought people are always going to need hospitals and doctors.
And people so die every day, right?
And little did I know that the amount of change that would occur over the years.
And so if you think back to that time, and then we'll get into a little bit about the Institute and how that came about. But you think back to that time, what were you dealing with as a CFO and COO at the health system in that particular time period?
It evolved over the years. I think every, you know, you're always looking at costs and how you can become more efficient. But a lot of it was strategy in terms of the revenue side, how to grow the business, how to partner with physicians, you know, how to compete in the marketplace in the best way possible.
And we, you know, we've had a couple of podcasts with CEO Mark of Baystate, and he was talking about cost and partnership. So it feels like maybe some of those same things are as current today as they were back then.
I think so. The thing I would say is I think that, and this is just my opinion, I think our healthcare system is, from a financial perspective, is somewhat broken. And I think that it's even more, you know, fragmented today and difficult to, you know, manage a bottom line than it was when I was actually a CFO. I think the market is so difficult for, you know, systems to squeeze margins out. And I think there's different strategies and different approaches that they're looking at. I mean, some of them, for the past, you know, 10 years, you've been seeing systems come together and looking to try to get to scale. And then I think now they're looking at diversification. So there's a lot of different ways that they're trying to cope with the situation that they're facing.
And back then, was it as prominent as it is today, and this is where we're going to transition a little bit at the Institute, about really thinking about alternative revenue streams?
No. Back prior to us starting the Innovation Institute, I think people were more focused on strategy and growing revenues and trying to keep, you know, growing the revenues at a faster pace than you could, than you're seeing the costs go up. And I think there was a lot of cost shifting dealing with, you know, trying to negotiate contracts with payers to stay ahead of the cost reductions. But I think today that strategy is no longer viable because the cost, I mean, the contracts, I mean, the health plan contracts, there's no more room for, you know, negotiating those large increases.
Right. And you were in probably a pretty good set of zip codes at St. Joe's, right?
I think. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we were in every market we were in, with the exception of maybe one or two, we were, you know, number one. And so we had, you know, a lot of leverage similar to a lot of the other large health systems that have been real successful. And so we were able to, you know, to leverage that, you know, market strength to get better rates and manage our profitability.
Right. And so you've seen sort of the many, many different systems come together. You've been at this for a long period of time. And I did talk to somebody else previously about this. But when you start thinking about the buzzword of scale and how much, you know, and we were joking before we started having a chat on the record about even my time at Premier, where it felt like every health system leader was talking about, all right, I got to get the scale, when really the ACA first took hold. Do you think that's as much sort of omnipresent sort of chatting at the administrative suite of health systems today as it was, say, even a number of years ago?
No, I don't. I think that people thought that getting to scale was going to be the solution to their problem because they'd be able to take out all those costs. And I think the incremental benefit after you get to a certain size of getting even larger is really not that beneficial. In fact, I think to a certain extent it could be detrimental because of the ability to manage over the size of the organization. And so I think that now people are looking at different strategies. I think you're going to see less of the mega mergers than what we've seen in the past 10 years.
Yeah, so it feels like it's slowed down a little. And obviously we had CommonSpirit come together with Dignity and CHI, which you know well, and that's a mega merger. I think they're at $23, $24 billion as a total system. But it feels like now people are examining back to this kind of alternative revenue stream. What does these health systems or platforms ultimately become? And depending on your zip codes and your geography or your multi-state approach, what do you need to be doing outside of the bounds of what you've done traditionally all the way back to the missionary days of delivering care?
You know, it was interesting because with St. Joseph, when I was there, they're kind of back from their early beginnings. They're instructed to go out into the communities, find out what the needs are, partner with others in collaboration, and try to meet the needs. And so if you think about that mission from the St. Joe's perspective, really that's what they need to do today, is they need to find partners in the industry to work with. And so I think you're seeing others enter the market. You hear a lot about Amazon. You hear, you know, the pharmacy industry in terms of, you know, these centers they have set up inside the actual CVS or the Minute Clinics and that type of thing. So you're seeing a lot of other entrants in the market, the retail space, and I think that there's a lot of opportunity depending on, I mean, there's risk involved in diversification, getting away from your core, but I think in order to protect their margin, I think they're going to have to do that.
So you've been, you know, this is not talked about a lot as well, and what this will be my last kind of thread on sort of the broader industry trends, but you've been part of mission-based or faith-based systems probably your whole career.
Yeah.
Right? And you think about back to that point of how that originally happened and what was the original intent of these mission-based systems, even to this day, to deliver the best possible care for the communities that they serve, regardless of reimbursement and all the things that are sort of about running the business side of this.
Right.
How does this play out in your mind as these large or even faith-based systems get much bigger, as they start thinking about other alternative revenue streams? Do you ever in your mind ever question us potentially even losing the core of what the original focus was to deliver care?
You know, I personally worry about that, because you see a lot of these congregations aging and you don't see them replacing themselves. And so a lot of the models are going away from, you know, being owned by a congregation, or not owned, but, you know, having the member be a congregation, to being more of a juridic person.
Yeah.
And I think you lose some of that mission focus. Yeah. when that happens. And because of the circumstances in the marketplace, it becomes more of a business. And so we used to talk a lot about margin and mission. And, you know, I was, as a CFO, I was always arguing that, you know, hey, we've got to have the cash flow and the margin in order to sustain the mission. But I'd get a lot of pushback from sisters, you know, saying it the other way. And so it was interesting. But seeing these sisters age, I think, you know, I worry about, you know, what that means for the future of faith-based, you know, Catholic healthcare.
And so with like CHA, Catholic Health Association, is that top of mind in that dialogue? A lot of people just do not understand the level of, one, how many faith-based systems we have in the country. Two, how significant the discussion and the pattern is and the association is of the Catholic-based systems. Is that top of mind as of the last 5 or 6 years with that association?
Yeah, and I think it has been with the association, and I think part of it is, you know, a lot of these congregations, they look for like-minded sisters, right, that they can kind of merge with. And, you know, they're ultimately the ones making a lot of the decisions on these mega mergers. I mean, it's not the business people or the boards of these health systems. It's the actual congregations have to be the ones that are okay with it, or it's not going to happen.
Right. Yeah, it's absolutely an interesting thing. And then so if you play with that a little bit and you start thinking about the origins, and I'd love to sort of really dig into this, you know, a lot of people know, some, you know, a good amount of people know about the innovations too, but a lot of people do not. And you know, especially probably more on the East Coast, is how did this come about? I mean, when you and I first started talking, it was the most fascinating thing, and I'm like, man, Joe's a freaking genius. Like no. this is a brilliant concept in terms of how you've thought about the business model, how you've thought about putting the pieces and parts together and thinking about short-term, mid-term, and long-term sort of approach to the business. And I'm just curious, because I don't think we've ever had the chat, like, how did this even start?
No, it's a great question. And first of all, I'm not a genius, and so appreciate the compliment. But back in 2013, actually at the time I was the COO, and we were looking at the Accountable Care Act and how that was going to impact us. And everybody across the country was saying, hey, we're going to have to take 15, 20% out of our cost structure. And I went to the CEO and I said, you know, we've got to think differently. We can't be like everybody else and just try to cut costs. We've got to introduce innovation. We've got to be able to deliver care in a different way. And so we did some research. We went out and we met with, you know, Geisinger, and talked with Cleveland Clinic and the Kaiser Garfield Center and Mayo. And we found that there were some really good innovation groups out there, but they were kind of based internally in these health systems. And we held a summit, and there was a lot of excitement. And Deborah Proctor at the time, the CEO, said, you know, hey, I want you to come up with something because I don't want this to just be a one-time thing. And so based on the research we did, I found that the ones that were embedded within these health systems were really focused on their own organization. And I wanted to create something that would be self-sustaining, that could be, you know, financially viable, and that would be similar to what the sisters had instructed or were instructed to do, would be a collaborative that would bring organizations together to focus on what the needs were. And in my experience as, you know, CFO at the hospital level, at the system level, and even COO, oftentimes I found that these clinicians, because, you know, their background is in science, and they want to make things better, and so they're always looking for how to improve things. And especially in nonprofit systems and community-based health systems, there was nowhere for them to go. So somebody would come to me with an idea, a great idea. I'd go to talk to legal and say, hey, let's invest in this concept. And they would say, we can't do it because this guy's one of our top physicians. He's an admitter, and there's all these compliance issues. And so it was frustrating seeing that, you know, they would go to either an academic center because there's not tech transfer in the nonprofit systems for the most part, or they'd go back to the manufacturer. They'd try to do it on their own. And in the end, if they were successful, I'd be paying more for a product that our own physician developed. And so out of that, we came up with the concept of, well, let's set up something that we can bring others together to work on. And Catholic healthcare talks a lot about, you know, coming together and working together, but they're just not really good at collaborating, in my opinion, in my experience. And so so we set this up, and to the credit of the board of St. Joseph, they agreed to set it up as a standalone organization. So it's a for-profit limited liability company, the Innovation Institute. We initially set it up to have 7 what we call member owners or investors, and we wanted it to be independent. So it's governed by this board, but they've basically delegated the day-to-day responsibilities to my management team. So we had the ability to be nimble in the marketplace, make decisions, and grow the organization, and we've had a lot of success with it to this point. The model itself is I don't know that there's another one out there like it. It's somewhat unique. Most incubators, when we did the research, about year 3, they go back and they start asking for more money because they've made their investments. And as you know, Keith, incubators, you know, it takes 7 years, you know, on average 5 to 7 years before you start seeing cash flow from a lot of the investments you make as a very early stage investment. And, you know, a lot of the incubators wouldn't be able to withstand that financially. So we set up a model where we actually have the incubator, and then we have this second element, which we call the Enterprise Development Group. And as a CFO, you know, I noticed that, you know, we were often outsourcing things to other companies, and it's, you know, for good reason, because, you know, it's the cyclical nature of business. But things like medical record coding or clinical engineering, taking care of the equipment in the hospitals, or, you know, construction management or staffing, those type of things. So rather than have, you know, the systems outsource that to somebody else, we thought if we can bring in those type of companies and have more of a shared services model where they can use those, we can use the margin from that to underwrite the innovation. So it sounds confusing, but basically these portfolio companies, they're not focused on innovation per se. They're the economic engine that underwrites the innovation.
Right.
So in the first, you know, several years, we were profitable within 6 months. This last year, we ended at about $265 million and about a $20 million EBITDA. And we've got, you know, maybe 10 products to market so far, and we've got a, you know, a startup company. So we're getting traction, we're getting engagement from these systems, and it's working really well.
So let's take that a little bit lower. So you, on one hand, it's sort of on each side of the spectrum, I always think about it as, where on one side, because it took me a while to sort of understand it, because I do think it's actually brilliant, because it is so different, to your point, that on one side, you have, you know, we talk about these alternative revenue streams back to this concept right now that's front and center in everybody's mind. And you're trying to tap into your 6 members today and making them understand that they have potentially alternative revenue streams sitting within the bounds of their base.
Yes.
Meaning that they have people that can innovate, you can commercialize. And so you've set up a lab, in essence, on this one side, in each one of these institutions. And so I can't remember the last count, but I think you guys have surfaced and run a process over the last, you know, as long as you've been in these institutions, but let's just say over the last year, like what, 2,000 plus ideations that have come through the lab?
Yeah, since 2013, we've had almost probably 3,000 disclosures that have been submitted that we've evaluated. And, you know, it's tapping into those physicians, the clinicians, and the employees in these systems, the ones that are on the front line. And oftentimes it's not a new molecule or something, you know, some big breakthrough. It's some simple solution that somebody has been dealing with a problem for years and had nowhere to take it. And now they have this safe place where they can take it. And I'll say that, you know, we don't take any of the IP that remains with the health systems. We facilitate the process. We have a staff of PhDs and tech transfer types and physicians that do the evaluation. We help, you know, protect the concepts that come through that have merit with getting, you know, patents. And then we work with them all the way through the commercialization process and taking it to market. And we have the ability to take a concept from just a nascent idea that's on a napkin, or to something that has already got a prototype, or to somebody that's already got a company that needs help. I mean, we have a crowdsourcing platform that we can help them with. We obviously have the LRV Health Fund that we can direct people to. And then we also, you know, we can, you know, invest and develop prototypes and help them with product development all the way to the commercialization stage.
And that's the part that, on the lab side, to me, I've been so impressed with, is the depth of your resources there that I don't see anywhere else, right? I see it sometimes in outsourced for-profit companies otherwise, but no one that's kind of running a collaborative across multiple systems and basically becoming their arm to be able to bring tech transfer out. So your ability to source ideas, you know, a lot of people don't know this, but you physically have people in the sites that are on your payroll that are helping to sort of figure out what they could actually do. Then you have people that are lawyers and others that can help on the IP side. You have people that can actually do prototype development. I've been at a couple of your events where it's amazing what you see over the course of a year, the level of development and insight that you all do from, I can't remember the last time, but someone was talking about something as simple as a walking cast. Yeah. And it was fundamentally a year plus research on what you would do along those lines. And that's, you know, I had dinner with somebody last night. I won't get into the details who, but a very senior healthcare administrator. And their comment, which I thought was dead on and is right on what we're talking about, was, I literally have 5,000 EIRs, executive in residence or entrepreneurs in residence, in my health system. And so you're there trying to untap all of that in a way that actually fosters it.
Yeah. It's a great point, and I wish I could share how passionate these physicians are, you know, with some of their ideas and their concepts, because oftentimes it comes about because of something that's happened in their practice, or even, you know, a family member or something, where they've got this passion to find a solution to a problem, and they just get really emotional or really excited about it. And when you hear them present, it's not like on Shark Tank where somebody comes forward and says, the market size is this and I'm going to make this many bazillion dollars. It's really about finding a solution. So oftentimes somebody will bring us a problem and we'll do the research and we'll come back and we'll say, well, there's already something on the market that they didn't know about. They're just as happy to find that solution as they are that their idea or their solution makes it through.
And I would think, and I don't think we talk about this enough, but if you think about clinician burnout, if you think about some of the morale issues that take place in some of these larger systems, even smaller systems, I would think this is a huge morale booster. So if I'm a CEO of a health system, administrator of a health system, I would love to have you guys in there with me sort of unpacking sort of this side of their brain, if you will, and this side of their work.
Yeah, it's actually, I think these physicians really get excited about it, as I said, and it's a safe place for them to bring their concepts, because, I mean, there's no dumb ideas. I mean, they can bring us whatever they want. And, you know, that's one thing, too, that we're real sensitive to. If somebody brings us an idea and it doesn't have merit or it doesn't have market size that's going to make it to where it's, you know, commercially viable, we're really good about the way that we tell them. And if we think something doesn't have potential, we'll give it back to them with the research telling them. But oftentimes that person's going to be a serial inventor, and so next time they come back, they may come back with something that's really significant.
So when you think about ideation, a lot of people talk about ideation, but a lot of people do not talk about the backside of that, which is commercialization. And so how successful have you been over the last couple of years of actually getting literally products on the shelf or, you know, to that end?
Yeah, and that has been a learning for me personally. I mean, I'm more of a finance person or an operations person, but we've got products to market. We've got one on the shelf at CVS. We've got several in Amazon. We've got several license agreements where we've licensed products to others and they've, you know, are taken to market. But it's not easy. And I think to navigate that on their own for a physician is nearly impossible.
Or even a system at some of these sizes, I assume, like the sophisticated ones maybe, but, you know, some of the mid-tier, even some of the larger health systems, you know, they don't necessarily have a tech transfer set up. They don't necessarily have a royalty transfer set up. So I assume you help with all that as well.
Absolutely. Yeah, we negotiate the agreements. We research in advance of, we don't wait till we get to the point of the signing a royalty agreement before we determine who it is that we would talk to. That's part of the evaluation process at the initial stage that we determine who in the market would we work with on this. And we also have co-development agreements. Where we, for example, we're working with Parker Hannifin on a new trach, and we've got another one where we're working with NTT Data on some software. And so oftentimes it's not a matter of just, you know, developing a concept to a certain point and then going out and signing a license agreement. Oftentimes we co-develop products.
Right. And then you have a bunch of sponsors as well, to your point, like NTT,
yeah,
McKinsey, and a few others, I
yeah,
think, right?
Deloitte and Boston Scientific. And
how does that work? Do they end up collaborating with you in some of that process? Or
yeah. So they can either, they get first look at our pipeline. So if there's something they want to work on together, they can bring us concepts they're working on that we can bring subject matter experts together to help, you know, co-develop. Or, you know, and they don't necessarily, they provide economic support to the lab yeah. in exchange for getting that access. Right. And it's been a really good relationship to this point.
And so to flip it over, and then on the other side of the business model, which I think is, this is why it's interesting, it's an interesting paradox, and it's financially makes all the sense in the world to me, and also has a, delivers an incredible service a lot of these institutions. I've seen some of this firsthand in my previous life as well. You have these EDG companies, these enterprise companies, your point of maybe, you know, you can bring up a couple of what those are. And those are the folks that, I don't know how many employees and how much revenue, I think you talked about a little bit earlier, but, you know, I almost said $300 million in revenue on those businesses.
Yeah, and that's worked really well. We've got 16 of them today, and the revenue is about $265 million last year. And each one of those is a separate limited liability company. And now we do treat those as a portfolio. So over time, we'll buy and sell those companies to obviously improve our margin and our position in the marketplace. But about half, a little over half of the revenue comes from the member systems. There's no requirement that they use them. We're not creating our own market. They have to want to use them. But if we can provide the same price or better quality, if they use them, it actually enhances their investment because then we can use the cash flow for innovation. But about half the revenue comes from outside organizations. You know, we sell it in the marketplace. As I said, each one is a separate limited liability company. Most of them we have probably 70% or higher equity in them. And a lot of them have been in business for 20, 30 years. And so there's different ways we acquire these companies. Some of them and this is interesting because I didn't expect this early on. We had a construction company approach us and say, if I contributed my business, could I retain some equity in it? And I was like, well, what's wrong with this guy's business? Why would someone give you their business like that?
Right.
But what they saw was the ability that we could scale their business. So It was they were doing about $20 million a year. We took them in. We took 70% of the company, set up a new co. Yeah. And the next year we did $40 million, and the next year we did $60 million, and now we're about over $80 million.
Wow.
And so the guy retained, 25-30% of the business, but we've grown it tremendously.
Wow.
And it's worked really well for both us and him because it didn't require a lot of investment then to basically get a revenue stream that would underwrite the innovation.
So you'll go in on most of these companies, you'll go in and take a controlling position.
Correct.
As part of the portfolio, almost like a private equity player, an early stage private equity player.
Exactly.
And afford them an ability to actually penetrate the network, plus your additional ability outside of even the folks that are in Innovation Institute members.
Right. And then we do tuck-in acquisitions. So to give you an example, we have a company called Technology Associates, which is a clinical engineering company. And we've acquired other clinical engineering companies and folded them in, and some others within vertically integrated. In other words, even though you have a clinical engineering company, you oftentimes have to outsource part of it, right, like scopes or whatever. Yep. And so we go out and find a scope company and bring that in. So there's ways that we've captured margin. We think of it as a revenue redirect. These health systems are already directing this revenue to somebody outside. Somebody's making a margin on it. If we can direct it to the Innovation Institute, they get the benefit of it, because it only enhances their investment. It also provides a savings to them, and we can use that money for innovation.
So when you step back and you think about the Institute and you think about that side of it, I mean, you absolutely have a successful market business on both sides of those equations, right? We've been a part of it, partnering with you guys for a couple of years now. And it's been interesting to watch. And so, to finish up sort of the Institute side of this is, you know, where does this go for you? So how many members do you have today?
Seven.
You have seven members today. And then is the idea to try to build that further? Is it to keep it kind of a tight-knit group and keep building out the EDG and keep building out the tech transfer stuff? I mean, how are you thinking about sort of the next phase of where you all go?
Well, it's interesting, because when we started, the reason we picked seven systems to start with is we thought we would be able to get to a scale that would be reasonable, and the governance structure would not be overly burdensome with 20 systems or some large number of people trying to bring them together. And it's worked really well, and in fact, to the point to where the members committee, which is each system, regardless of how much they invest, get a seat on what we call the members committee, and that's the highest governance body of the Innovation Institute. And so they get one vote, but again, they delegate the responsibility to management. But they've said, you know, hey, there's no magic about seven, so if you want to add more, we can. But the other thing we've thought about is maybe setting up, because there's a minimum investment of $10 million to be a member owner. And again, it's an investment, so it stays in your balance sheet. If a system was to try and do it on their own, the cost in the first year would be $10 million, and they would have no asset. Here, they invest,
and
we're profitable already, and so they got an asset that's on their balance sheet that's growing, and we provide the infrastructure because we put the staff, like you said, out in their systems.
Yeah, but most of those folks, I would think, are just really back to the either side of the ladder, if you will. They're spending most of their time just on the tech transfer stuff. They don't even have the benefit of the EDG growth,
right,
and the EBITDA growth off that.
And that's what I'm saying. So that's providing, they get a return on their investment, and they get the infrastructure for free, because we're putting we're putting that staff out there. We've got the tech transfer team here. We've got the software that manages all this. And so it's a really a great way for a system to bring in innovation without making taking a P&L hit, because they invest, they get a return, and they get the infrastructure they need.
So this is a perfect example of what we used to call shared infrastructure.
Exactly.
Right? But again, trying to get typical, most health systems trying to agree on something as shared infrastructure is a little bit easier than said, right? I mean, a little harder than said.
And just to give you a little background, that's exactly right. When we started, St. Joe's was the initial investor. And then when I went out to get the second system, until I got St. Joseph diluted, they're really investing in St. Joseph. And so it was really difficult early on. And because the point, one Catholic system to another, they'd say, well, I can do that. I don't need, And so in the end, after I got past that hurdle with the second and third investor and got St. Joseph diluted, then I had systems coming to me wanting to be part of it.
Right.
And so it was interesting just to see how that played out. And it kind of proves the point that these systems, it's hard for them to work with other systems in a collaborative way. And maybe it's changed today, but I don't think so. But
I think the pressure gets hard enough, it will change. But I'm 100% with you, having done this for a long time too, is getting everybody to work together on shared infrastructure. I mean, what you just explained is like a no-brainer to me. Like, why wouldn't you do that? Right? You've got deeper resources on the innovation side, the tech transfer side. You've got these EDG companies that are spitting out EBITDA year after year, and that's growing. And it's on your balance sheet and growing it on the enterprise value. That seems like a true no-brainer. But everybody's on their own, right? Everybody likes to think the way they think in each one of their regions. So I think the more of us that try to think about how do we really kind of build together, kind of, no different than LRB Health Platform, we're trying to build a collaborative investing platform by which everybody can share and learn. I think the market comes there in time, frankly. Well, Joe, this has been great. I guess the last question, which is by far the most important question, because as I've gotten to know you over the last couple of years, you're a small baseball fan. And so the million-dollar last question is, is the Dodgers, are the Dodgers actually going to win the World Series this year after two at bats, you know? And not that I want to bring up the Red Sox last year, but you know.
Just so you all know, I lost a bet last year to Keith with the Red Sox and the Dodgers, and it killed me. So I think the Dodgers, with the best record in baseball this year, I think they've got a better chance than they did in the last 2 years. I think that there's a really good chance they're going to win the World Series, and I'm hopeful. So.
I heard something yesterday, and we'll finish on this, that there is no better farm system in the league than the Dodgers. They continue to promote these guys that are just absolute studs. So I actually, ironically, I am 100% rooting for the Dodgers this year. And after last year, I think you guys deserve it after two runs at this. I don't want you guys to be the Buffalo Bills of baseball. That's not where we want to go with this.
We need them to win. That's my fear. If they get there again and lose this year, they'll be the Buffalo Bills. But,
well, Joe, thanks again. This has been awesome. And really appreciate your insight. And again, another classic case of an insider that's been in this game for a long period of time and understanding really, really unique insights across the industry. So I appreciate you, and I appreciate the partnership, and I appreciate getting to know more about the Innovation Institute.
Thanks, Keith. I really enjoy working with you.
All right, well, that is a wrap. Thanks so much for joining us on this episode of Healthcare is Hard, a podcast for insiders. I'll have some podcast news for you in a moment. But first, I wanted to tell you, we're hosting the Digital Healthcare Innovation Summit on December 9th and 10th at the Mandarin Oriental Hotel in Boston. I'm very excited to be working with our co-chairs, Bill Geary of Flare Capital and Robert Mittendorf of Norwest Venture Partners. We'll be working together to put together a fantastic program. Very happy to have the help of our advisory board as well, and look forward to bringing you this event. It's going to have a few changes. I know you'll like it. So stay tuned. We'll have some updates on this podcast, and you, of course, can go to dhis.net for more information. As far as the podcast goes, we're going to be taking the month of August off. No podcast next month, but Keith Figlioli of LRV Health will be back at work in September. He already has some great interviews lined up, and we'll be very pleased to bring you those. Please do subscribe so you don't miss any. You can also track Keith and I on Twitter. Keith is at Keith Figlioli, F-I-G-L-I-O-L-I, and I am at MedTech Tom. I hope you have a terrific summer. And we really look forward to seeing you in September on the podcast as well, but also seeing you on December 9th and 10th in Boston at the Digital Healthcare Innovation Summit.